This is the State of Things from the Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. World War I was supposed to be the war to end all war. Well, it may have put an end, didn't do that, in fact, at all, but it did put an end to whatever romantic ideas we still had about war. This change was reflected almost immediately in the arts. In his new book, David Lubin showcases artists' range of reactions to World War I. The book is called Grand Illusions, American Art and the First World War. David is a professor of art at Wake Forest University. He reads from his book tonight at Rinalda House and Museum of American Art in Winston-Salem, and he is on our program now. David, welcome to the State of Things. David Lubin.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you.
Let's talk about this moment in art, I guess, and World War I and the connection it had. It was a great break in the arts, right? The fact of the war itself had a great impact on artist imagination.
Well, for a long time, people have thought that World War I had very little effect on American art. It was always seen as having kick-started modernism in Europe, but the Americans were seen almost as reactionary, promoting the war but not really changing the war or changing their attitudes about the war. I had an instinct that that wasn't right, and that's sort of why I set out to write the book, was just to do research to find out how a whole variety of different American artists, illustrators, filmmakers, advertisers, how they responded to the war. And I'll just say that there is no one-size-fits-all response. Some people started off anti-war and became pro-war. Other people started off very much pro-war and became anti-war. And some people never changed their minds at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fascinating. When we think about the European response, the artistic response, it was one of horror. The center isn't holding, and we begin to see the rules fall apart. But it's not so with Americans. Many became even more fiercely patriotic in some ways. Is that accurate? Or at least, as you say, pro-war?
Well, and then, well, see, there's another trajectory there. Some American artists became increasingly patriotic, rapidly patriotic and pro-war during the course of the war. And then when it was over and the troops came home, people had a hangover about war and their sort of war enthusiasm. And they're saying, what did we allow ourselves to be sucked into? And so then there was a reaction against the war. And that's when, in the 1920s, when you started having a series of anti-war novels and artworks, movies like All Quiet on the Western Front.
Well, let's talk about you. You start your book actually comparing the work of two artists whose work, and we're going to talk about two particular pieces, actually were created sort of on the threshold of the war, not in reaction to it. But tell us about Man Ray and his piece, which was initially just called War, and then we'll compare that to Marsden Hartley, right?
Yes. Man Ray was a young artist living in New Jersey on a socialist commune in New Jersey, and he was one of America's first modernist artists. And he was married to a woman from Belgium. And as the first reports came out of the war in 1914 and the atrocities that were being committed in Belgium, that made Man Ray sit up and take notice. He was working on a Cubist work. He wanted to be a Cubist painter. But then the war sort of inspired him to do a Cubist war painting. And I'd have to say it's one of his worst works.
This is it. Describe it for us.
Well, what it shows is these almost medieval-looking figures on horseback fighting infantrymen. It's based actually on an early Renaissance painting by the artist Uccello. And Man Ray was looking at Uccello's work from the 1400s, Uccello is one of the inventors of one-point perspective. And Man Ray wanted to understand how perspective worked, to go back to the roots of it. But his artwork showing these soldiers fighting in a forest, although based on that earlier time, really had no concept of what World War I was going to entail. There are no gas masks. There's no barbed wire. I mean, the war that broke out in 1914 was so different from anything that ever occurred in history. And so Man Ray is kind of looking at wars of the past as a way of understanding the war of the present and the future, and he really didn't get it right.
But he tries to universalize it by adding a date in Roman numerals to the title, right? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so then his wife said to him, you know, this really does remind me of the war going on. And so he paints in the corner on a rock in Roman numerals, the year AD 1914, making the point that the timelessness of war continues into the present.
But you've got the ancient period represented, the medieval period, and of course this is all happening in the context of this industrialized, the world's first industrial war, right?
But see, in 1914, people didn't understand it was the first industrialized war. They just thought it was going to a war that was going to be over by Christmas. That's what everybody said. It's going to be over by Christmas. And so, and it was sort of the chivalric French soldiers versus German soldiers. I mean, people went into battle on horseback. The machine gun cured them of that very quickly. And
Well, then we get to, but it is a critique. I mean, the idea that this has been with us forever and it's not a good thing. But then we get to Marsden Hartley's portrait here, portrait of a German officer, and it's a much more romantic look, at least in the imagery, at the imagery of war.
Marsden Hartley is one of my favorite figures in the book, and he comes up in the beginning and then toward the end of the book. He was someone, he was an avant-garde painter, originally from a small town in Maine. His patron was a great art modernist patron named Alfred Stieglitz, who gave Hartley money, who Hartley was so impecunious. He had no money, but Stieglitz gave him money to go to Paris and meet with the Cubists. He went to the salon of Gertrude Stein, got to know Gertrude Stein. But then he went to Berlin, this is in 1913, because he was in love with a young German cavalry officer. And one of the reasons Hartley went to Berlin, besides the fact that he loved this officer, was that it was a gay-tolerant city. It was the most sort of advanced city in Europe for tolerance of sexual difference. And so Hartley felt more comfortable there than he did back in America. Well, when the war began, this German officer that he was in love with perished early on in the Battle of the Marne, and Hartley was heartbroken, and he tried to find a way to express his feelings of sadness about this death and about all the people who were dying. But particularly as a gay man, he didn't feel like he could come out and express this in a representational form. So he used symbols of the man's initials, his spurs from his horse, the flag under which he fought, and he puts these together in these Cubist collages that are some of the most brilliant works to come out of World War I. Although recently I was in Germany, in Berlin, finally had a show of Marsden Hartley's war paintings, and the people who came to that, I gave a talk at it, and these Germans were saying, this man is incredible. We had no idea that we had this great artist in our midst. He's really forgotten. It's only now being rediscovered.
It strikes me, though, when I look at this, I mean, he's romanticizing at least the imagery, the bravery, the chivalry of war, right? Using, and this is interesting in this particular moment, the first part of the 20th century, this kind of symbolism that will marshal you into madness, and in a mass culture, what this is going to mean in the public relations industry in the following century, and what it means today in our current political milieu, how symbols can be manipulated to drive people crazy. Here, he's very sentimental about it, isn't he?
Yes.
This is also, but let's talk about propaganda and how people begin to use artists and others and politicians to begin to manipulate symbols to push us in one direction or another. Propaganda is a very important part of the story.
It is. And in every war that Americans had gone to before, propaganda wasn't necessary. Once the government determined a course of action, most people patriotically fell in line and sort of went with it. World War I, we weren't attacked. There was no Pearl Harbor moment. The government, once they decided we needed to get people into the war, they had to find a way to make people want to go to war. That's actually one of the things that made me want to write this book, was trying to understand how today we get manipulated into going to war, how do visual images and how do popular narratives make us think it's the right thing to do to choose arms rather than diplomacy. Well, this really begins with the Americans in World War I.
So tell us about this now. Some of this is really deliberately, I mean, it's propaganda posters, right? Talk about Enlist.
This, to me, this picture that the radio audience can't see right now, but Frank is holding up, was from a poster that was issued in 1915. It shows a beautiful young woman sinking in a ball gown, sinking to the bottom of the sea, holding a baby in her arms. And it's a very haunting, ethereal image, and there's simply one word, Enlist. Now, Americans in 1915 understood quite instantly this is a reference to the Lusitania, a British ocean liner that was sunk by a German submarine. There were 128 Americans on board, and the stories had it that among the bodies found that washed up to shore was a young mother clasping an infant to her breast. So this was such a powerful image. And for me, this is almost the beginning of modern advertising, because it's advertising a war. It's trying to get people to get motivated to go to war because of this extreme event that had happened. And instead, if you look at advertising pre-World War I, a typical ad has a very small drawing and then lines and lines and lines of text, verbose text, why this tooth powder is the best powder you should buy. Well, what World War I inspired people, advertisers, to do, and they learned from this, is if you have one striking image and a minimum of text, that's much more effective. It's much more eye-catching and persuasive than the long reason.
To the extent that a guy named Edward Bernays accompanies Woodrow Wilson to the Versailles Treaty talks in order to use what he would then coin the term public relations in an effort to use just this kind of stuff to convince the leaders of Europe that the Treaty of Versailles was the way to go. And he's the guy who actually creates public relations. It's right in this moment. Right?
Yeah. So Edward Bernays, who only died a few years ago at age 100, 102, it always claimed that he was the father of public relations. He's known as the father of public relations. One thing that's so interesting is, let's get my mic in the right place here.
Keep going.
Yes, that's so interesting about this man. He was born in Vienna. He came to America when he was a young man. It so happens that his uncle was Sigmund Freud, and he loved Freud, and he loved Freudian concepts. And what Edward Bernays tried to do was take Uncle Ziggy's ideas about human motivation and behavior and anxiety and twist those around for commercial purposes.
To very great success and to our great sorrow, I have to say. Tell us about this one, because now here we're going beyond just an appeal to patriotism, right? Here, there's actually a not-so-subtle racism included in this particular poster. Describe it for us.
So one of the posters that came out after America entered the war in April of 1917, 2 years after the Lusitania sinking. And one of the images that was trying to inspire people, men, to go to war. Think about it. Again, they hadn't been attacked. The Lusitania had happened, but America, the homeland itself, had not been attacked. You needed to frighten people or make people think they need to go to a foreign land to fight. So there was this amazing image called Destroy This Mad Brute that shows a raging, snarling gorilla with a German helmet on his head carrying a half-naked white woman in his arms. And he's jumped across from the European shore onto a shoreline that says America. And the ad was basically enlist and fight the Germans, or they will bring this here. They will rape our women if we don't do something to them there. This image, of course, if you look at it, you'll think it's King Kong all over the place. Well, King Kong wasn't for another 15 or 20 years, but the makers of King Kong knew this image quite well and were inspired by it.
And this sort of bestial image plays in, because this is also the moment in history where D.W. Griffith rises, and it'll just be a year later that Birth of a Nation screens in America, right?
Yeah, so one of the greatest movies ever made and one of the most heinous racist movies ever made, it's a paradox, was D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, 1915, that really retooled the way cinema was done. Any movie you see today couldn't have done what it did without Griffith's innovations. But the man who was, he was a very bad racist, and he made a movie showing about how black soldiers, Yankees from the North, black Yankees in particular, were raping and violating the South. You know, literally their women, but also more metaphorically. And I think the makers of these posters realized they could take the energy and furor that came from movies like Birth of a Nation and transpose it to the European situation.
It was a highly successful film in re-energizing the Ku Klux Klan, a favorite of Woodrow Wilson. He loved the film. Charles Aycock, former governor of North Carolina, or a man who had become governor of North Carolina, and one of the leaders in the Wilmington coup d'etat, was his chief of staff, was Woodrow Wilson's chief of staff. These threads, these artistic and political threads, are
and
really coming together,
Frank,
in this
you may not
moment.
Know this, but Birth of a Nation was written by Thomas Dixon, who was a Wake Forest College graduate. We were not necessarily proud of his contribution there.
Well, tell us more about this, because there are some other artists, and I want to talk about some of the ones who you feature in your book. Again, you're focusing on American artists here, Child Hassam and George Bellows. Tell us about them.
Well, Child Hassam was America's great impressionist painter. And he had studied in Paris. He loved the work of the Impressionists. And he was the one basically who brought Impressionism back to the United States and did these scintillating, beautiful, beautiful images. There's actually a show of his work at the North Carolina Museum right now, well worth seeing. So Hassam was a great patriot. He believed America. In 1916, he felt America should go to war in Europe. I have to explain, America in 1916 was completely divided. About half the nation thought we should go to war on behalf of the British and the French. The other half of the nation didn't want to go to war, or if anything, wanted to go to the war on the side of the Germans. Our largest ethnic group was German-American. Irish Americans were a huge ethnic group, and they didn't want to fight on behalf of the British. They wanted to fight against the British. So there was a lot of deciding back and forth, and Childe Hassam's paintings, these beautiful impressionistic paintings, he put in the service of the war cause by showing flags of the Allied nations flying over Fifth Avenue and other great thoroughfares.
And contrast him with George Bellows, or tell us his story.
Well, George Bellows was the founder of somebody, what we call the Ashcan School. He, instead of trying to show beautiful urban scenes, he wanted to show the urban grit, the messiness, the stinkiness of modern life. And so more middle-class viewers were much put off by Bellows' attitude. Bellows was very much an urban anti-war person, and he felt that war was just something that the elites were trying right. to throw on the common man. So he starts off as an anti-war figure, but then he starts reading reports of atrocities committed by the Germans in Belgium, and he's so indignant, he's so outraged, and he feels, I'm too old as an artist to go over and fight, but I have paintbrushes, I have canvases. I can fight the war with images. And so then he starts making what now seem to us egregiously, over-the-top propaganda images of Germans bayoneting babies and cutting the hands off innocent people. And a lot of that was later found to be propaganda, was mythologizing. But Bellows was very much sucked into that.
So give us a sense of the impact in this, the legacy of these movements and these currents in American art here at the beginning of the 20th century, and the impact of the war on art in the future in the United States.
Well, Americans, the nation as a general, after the war happened, I had mentioned America became a pacifist nation. Many people didn't want to join the League of Nations in Europe. They didn't want to have anything to do with the bad troubles that were happening, brewing again in Europe. And actually, one of the knock-on effects of that, one of the legacies of that, is when Hitler came to power with the rise of fascism in the 1930s, most Americans said, hey, it's their problem. Let them deal with it. We're not going to intervene. Last time we intervened, we got bamboozled. We got swung into something where we didn't really belong. And so even when there were reports of the Holocaust were first coming to America, Americans said, it's just made up. Once again, the British are just doing propaganda. Let's forget it. And actually, the art world itself in America, I think, turned away from anything sort of representational art that might be considered too political, too partisan, too seeking abstraction, sort of apolitical abstraction.
David Lubin is my guest. He's a professor of art at Wake Forest University and author of the new book, Grand Illusions, American Art and the First World War. He reads tonight at 6 o'clock at Rinalda House Museum of American Art in Winston-Salem. David Lubin, thank you so much for being on our program.
Thank you, everybody.
Just ahead, some music from a Greensboro group is going to pay tribute to gospel singer Sister Rosetta Tharpe. Here's a sample as we go into our break. Stay with us.
Let me stand. I'm tired.